Today, we are not going to pass out in work session Senate Bill 555. We will have a brief discussion on the DAPSCAN amendments and where we are. And on Senate Bill 841, I am going to hold that until I get the other victims' rights HJRs from the House side. And on 1247, on privatization and prison commission, we won't have that today either, and that there's going to be an amendment. So with that, we will open a public hearing on, a work session on Senate Bill 555, and I invite Pam Curtis and Steve Marsh to come forward. The dash 10s are not perfect yet, but we've made improvements. And I spent the weekend, had some time, and went over these. And actually, what helped me was I did an index of the 38 sections. So I could follow what was going on, and that assisted me. It's my understanding from the work group that there has been a general consensus once we get the drafting correct. So, Bobby, would you like to begin, or how would we like to start today?
Why don't I thank you very much, Senator Brian, Chair Brian, and members of the committee. Also, I want to thank you for scheduling this meeting at this time at the request of AOC. So I think what we'll do, we'll have Pam Curtis do some opening comments, and then Commissioner Gina Furman, our second vice president for AOC, will make a few comments, and then Commissioner Randy Frankie, in his role as the chair for the local coalition directors, then I'll just kind of wrap it up at that point.
And as I recall, AOC had two meetings, one Friday and one this morning. Is that correct?
Actually, we had one Friday, one this morning, but I also had a telephone conference last Monday and Tuesday. So we looked at this one pretty closely.
Okay. Thank you. Okay.
Chair Bryant, members of the committee, for the record, Tom Curtis from the governor's office. Again, I want to repeat Bobby's thanks to the chair and the committee for allowing us the opportunity to sort of negotiate and find some consensus on this. I think the Dash 10 represents very close consensus among all of the parties who worked on this. I want to take just a minute to highlight some of the significant pieces that may be new to you, and also what we've done to accommodate the interests of the Dash 5, 6, 7, and 9 amendments, and then finally to tell you 4 points that in reviewing the Dash 10 amendments did not make it into this particular draft from our work group discussions. So briefly, highlights or areas that we sort of added include in the review that the State Commission on Children and Families makes of coordination policies, making sure that those policies are consistent with the Children's Care Team report and the policies for services that were set there, including the policies around family resource and family service centers. And we did that to accommodate some of the concerns and language that were in the Dash 5 amendments. Another significant piece is that we added a role for the State Commission on Children and Families in reporting to the governor and to the legislature on the status of local service systems and their capacity to do both the planning and the service delivery that's called for in this legislation and in the role of the state and local commissions on children and families. Third, we included quite a bit of language around the role of the commissions on children and families, particularly locally in mobilizing communities and evaluating outcomes and engaging citizens. Fourth, we, to accommodate the Dash 7 amendments, added some language in Section 32 of the bill to accommodate basic services grants to local juvenile departments. That was not in previous versions of the bill other than the Dash 7 amendments. In Section 34, we established a waiver process for counties who want to use any of their high-risk juvenile resources for early intervention with younger children. That partially is to accommodate concerns of some specific counties, but also some of the Dash 5, 6, and 9 amendments. In Section 19, which is an early childhood section of the bill, previous sections of the bill included a statewide early childhood coordination process. We added a local early childhood coordination process to mirror other sections of the bill. So this will look a lot like coordinating services around juvenile crime prevention, only for early childhood services. And to that end, the work group added language that required any early childhood program or service to be part of this coordinated plan to accommodate Dash 5, 6, and 9 amendments. So that, I think, highlights some of the work that the group did that was new. The Dash 10 amendment does not reflect, I think, just by omission in drafting four particular points that the work group worked on, and they are the following. In Section 5 of the bill, we did some work to define the role of education, both the department and local school districts. We wanted to remove something in an earlier version that was left in this bill. That's the same for Section 9. There was some language around the role of the department and local school districts that was removed in earlier but was not removed in this version. Third, in Section 12, we want to change one word from may to shall. This regards the role of the local commissions on children and families in mobilizing communities. And finally, Section 35 from the Dash 8 version was omitted from the Dash 10 version, and it was something that was important to the work group. It was some language that required the Juvenile Crime Prevention Advisory Committee to coordinate federal high-risk juvenile programs so that rather than setting up two separate processes, we're consistently coordinating into one. So those were accidentally not included, I think, in the Dash 10 version of the bill.
Okay. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Chair Bryant, members of the committee. I'll use this one. My name is Gina Furman. I'm a commissioner from Tillamook County. I'm AOC's second vice president and also chair of the JCPAT. We spent quite a bit of time on 555 in telephone conferences, and last Friday in Bobby's committee of the Human Services Committee, we spent quite a bit of time discussing this. It was recommended that we pass it out to the Association of Warden County's legislative body that met today, and I am here to tell you proudly that we unanimously wanted to tell you that we passed this at the Association of Warden Counties. After much discussion throughout the last year and just several weeks on 555, we feel very good about this, and with the Dash 10 amendments plus the four items that Pam said that were omitted. And so here we are saying we support this. I see that Commissioner Franke is not back, just not wanting to really speak for him, but since he's not here, I'll go ahead and do that. He is with a coalition of Commission on Children and Families, local Commission on Children and Families, and they also had a chance to discuss this in detail. And they were a part of the meeting last Friday in which they also recommend that 555-10 is something that they can live with.
Thank you. Questions? Yes, Senator Turner.
Mr. Chairman, who it is that can tell me what the definition of a healthy community is? What is a healthy community? If it's economically depressed, I don't know if it's healthy or not, like my county is right now.
I'd say if it's economically depressed, you're going to have problems that will not make it a healthy community. Mr. Franke, is there anything you wish to add?
Yeah.
Thank you. Chair Bryant, members of the commission, I apologize. I forgot to turn off my phone, which I usually remember to do. But it was a call about my daughter, so it was an important call to take anyway. So I think everybody's covered everything. The last issue which came before the from the local commissions, the AOC Legislative Committee adopted unanimously this morning, which was to change that may to shall on page 15, line 8 of the Dash 10. I think I remember the page and line correctly. Make that may a shall in terms of local commission duties and responsibilities, and the AOC folks agreed with that, so if that can be done, we'd be pleased, and I just say we're very pleased with the process and negotiations to come to where we've come to on this bill.
Thank you. As I read it this weekend, a couple things came to mind that you probably discussed already, but I thought it might be a good idea on the progress board part to include a report from the progress board that indicates how helpful state agencies have been in working on this coordinated plan along with counties. Because one of the things this is intending to do is require everyone to cooperate and have good communication. And I think it would be a good indication for the progress board to ask that question and get a response and provide that information not only to the people involved but also to the legislature. So I don't know if Jeff Hines can draft such a thing, but coordination is probably a word that's in process used in this more than anything else. And there are 7 or 8 state agencies involved and 36 children and families commissions in the county. So I'd be curious to see how that coordination works, and in particular when you're reporting back and forth to one another. On page 3, on line 30, where it exempts the Department of Education, and then it says school districts that are related or that are related to curriculum, I understand and I agree with that. And I'm presuming that the phrase related to curriculum also describes the programs or services provided by the Department of Education. So that's a descriptor for both the Department of Education and school districts in that sentence. Am I right on that?
Chair Bryant, members of the committee, the intention, I think, of the distinction that the work group wanted to make here is that for the purposes of coordination and collaboration, both the Department of Education and local school districts ought to be at the table when we're talking about a holistic look for kids and families. The distinction being that local commissions on children and families should somehow not be in charge of setting policies and guidelines for the curriculum and instruction of school districts and education departments.
Right. I guess what I'm suggesting is that on the table for discussion then would be your early intervention programs like Together for Children and Head Start. I mean, to me, in a coordinated plan, that would have to be part of the conversation.
Chair Bryant, that was the intention of the work group.
Good. And I have just a couple more thoughts. Oh, on page 8, if the State Commission should disapprove, I thought it would be good to put in a timing element. In another section, it says that if they disapprove, it'll be done within 90 days that the plan's received, and there'll be reasons stated in writing for why there is disapproval. That helps the communication. And then up above that in C, approval of expenditures, it's my understanding that this doesn't mean micromanagement or line item type of situation, but just general approval of expenditures so that you know the resources are being spent in the right manner. Is that correct?
Yes, Chair Bryant. It would probably also be useful to clarify that when we're referring to approval of expenditures, we're referring to approval of state expenditures allocated to those local commissions, not county-related expenditures that would be allocated.
I was hoping you'd say that because I added the word state in front of expenditures just to clarify that. And then on that same page, the next subparagraph C, it says, in conjunction with Department of Human Resources, using staff resources and other resources, the State Commission educate, inform, and provide technical assistance to local commissions. I was curious that the Department of Human Resources is mentioned there and the State Commission, but the other state agencies that are involved in the coordinated plan aren't mentioned, Oregon Youth Authority, Crime Commission. Was that intentional or are they intending to provide some technical assistance too?
Excuse me, Chair Bryant. The intention is that all the state agencies would work together to provide technical assistance. The reason this particular subsection is worded the way that it is was that we combined the technical assistance language from the State Commission that the work group intended with some existing language around technical assistance that would come through the Department of Human Resource. It was existing language from the old 2004, and it particularly applied to the language in sub A on line 23 and 24 around federal laws and regulations, since most of the human service federal resources and the regulations around this come through DHR.
Then on page 22, section 19, I can't find it. At some point, it talks about the state appointing the lead agency, I believe, and I've read this too many times to find it at the moment, but my question was, won't the lead agency be the State Commission on Children and Families?
Chair Brandt, section 19 does not, unless I misread it, specify a lead agency at the state, but rather starting on lines 5, 6, and 7 there, talk about those agencies together, working together to set policies, and then asking the Board of Commissioners on line 26 to establish a lead agency in each community.
In the local level. So at the state level, then, there won't be a lead agency. It will be the State Commission, Department of Education, Human Resources, et cetera, that will provide a teamwork approach. Is that the intent?
Chairman, I think it is the intent to establish a lead agency for different functions, but much as has been done with the juvenile crime side of things, we are not far enough along in that work to determine who will be the lead for fiscal versus planning versus other roles and functions.
And our last question was, on line 19, page 35, it talks about overseeing approved funding policy recommendations from the Federal Juvenile Justice and Delinquency Prevention Act of 1994. And I understand this is some of the federal money that flows in, and the reason, and there are strings and requirements of how that money is spent. And am I correct that under the federal program, it's supposed to be planning 0218?
Chair Brian, that's the existing emphasis has been on adolescents and high-risk youth. My understanding is they're moving towards something called a comprehensive strategy, which does include 0 to 18.
Final comment on 39, page 39, subsection B, where it says to implement the recommendations of the Juvenile Crime Prevention Advisory Committee as approved by the governor. Mm-hmm. You might want to say and the legislature. Just a good political move there. I'm sure it was implied.
Kind of question. I'm just curious that could a county commission designate itself as the agency of the organization that was referred to by Senator Bryan, you folks on page 22? Could a county commission be designated itself as the agency?
There's nothing, Chair Bryant, Senator Courtney, there's nothing in this bill that would prohibit that.
The reason I ask is that I was listening to some of your testimonies a long time ago, and some of the counties have so few people. The same people are on all the same boards. They don't have as many people. Therefore, I was wondering if you were going to allow this or to make sure that there's no situation you allow for those kinds of counties to have that kind of whatever you want to describe it. So I guess you can take that into consideration, and then it's taken care of and everything.
Chair Brian and Senator Courtney, in response to that, your assessment is correct. Many of the same people do serve on many of the same commissions, and in most cases we're always talking to one another. So that opportunity, that situation will always exist in most counties. So there's nothing that would prevent the county commission from taking on that role.
Okay. And just, I know it's in here, but I noticed it include all early childhood development services for children who are prenatal to 8 years of age. You specify that on lines 11 and 12 and 23. Where do you specify 8 through 18 in here?
Mm-hmm.
There's a good commissioner from Marion County. That's my county. So I have a right to react to his body language. He's grinning like me, but he's got an incredible shirt on. So what is that? What is he trying to tell me with his body language?
Well, the good commissioner from Marion County has better explain that
one. I was smiling, actually, because I'm always amazed how well you read this stuff and how detailed you can be in your questions, Senator Courtney.
I think we focused mainly, at least from our side, we were looking to 08 issue on early childhood. The governor's high-risk juvenile crime initiative was focused on the later age kids. And so there was a lot of age group discussion in those areas. But there are a couple of places. One would be on page 3. It does talk about programs, strategies, and services for children from 0 to 18. So that age group was not left out of the continuum, although it wasn't spoken to, I guess, in the detail that some of the other age groups were.
So it's in there. It just doesn't get that specific designation of 0 to 8.
Right.
In your opinion.
Yes, that's right.
And I can conclude from that that there is something in there from 8 to 18 in terms of programs and services and the county commission's view of real life that those kids, regardless of where they may be in terms of adjudication of facilities and things, are part of the scenario still. I'm not trying to, believe me, totally going along, you've worked very hard, congratulations. I'm just trying to make sure that we understand, that I understand that we're not just talking, and I know where Senator Gerser is, and maybe the chair and others are, but to me, I'm the whole group, and that's all I want to make sure.
Senator Courtney, Chair Bryant, yes, one of the concerns all along from the local Children and Families Commission is that we do not forget the continuum and the importance of working with community for kids 0 through 18, and while we're very willing to work and provide additional emphasis on the early childhood piece, which certainly needs it, we didn't want to lose the concept of the continuum 0 to 18. So there are a number of places addressed in there, and I can assure you that local commissions are very attuned to that issue.
Other questions to the panel? Yes, Senator Brown.
Pam, you mentioned the waiver process and for what some of the local areas, and I can't remember what page and section that was in.
Section 34.
Okay.
And the waiver section has been important to Deschutes County, but it applies to other counties too.
Okay.
It can apply to any county that qualifies, so it offers more flexibility.
Thanks, Beth.
Thank you. Other questions? Thank you for your testimony.
Okay.
Thank you. I would next invite Lauren Irving and Linda Swearingen. Those of you that are waiting on the three PERS bills, the amendments aren't ready, so we will have those before us tomorrow. And in particular, we'll concentrate on 722. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
These are my people.
That's right. I've never been called Senator Bryant's people before, but you know what? I think that's appropriate, and it's always nice to come before your people. And I'd just like to say I'm the chair of the Deschutes County Commission, and I'm here to ask for your support of SB 555-10. Deschutes County has spent a great deal of time and money over the past years taking care of high-risk juveniles. In fact, the voters in Deschutes County in the past 3 years have approved a $7.7 million juvenile facility. In fact, we went from being able to handle 8 juveniles to 42. And I mentioned earlier to Steve Marks, we just increased our general fund commitment to the juvenile department by 50% this year alone. In the past 2 years, we've increased our general fund dollars to the rate of 107% of the budget. So we're committed to taking care of those individuals. Now that we've done that, we'd like to be able to allocate some of our dollars through this early waiver, early intervention waiver, to 0 to 11-year-olds, and we believe that we've committed the necessary resources in capital improvements and operations and maintenance to handle the higher-risk individuals. And we now believe that what we need to do is to allocate some money towards the younger individuals. And that's why Lauren and I are here today, is to ask your support of this. And Lauren, as a commission and families member, you want to just kind of...
I'm not on that commission and families, but I have been involved with, I'm in the lumber business, and so took a day off. I took a half a day off here from an otherwise very boring day this morning at the lumber end of it. I've been involved in nonprofit projects in Central Oregon for some time, and I really appreciate the opportunity to testify and say hello from Deschutes County to you. As a community and as a parent, there's not any particular one answer to what it takes to having kids turn out to be good citizens, and that really is our goal in all this effort. I really do believe that it is a combination of prevention and early intervention, as well as the high-risk crime prevention part that will really work. I also want to bring your attention to the idea that dollars directed with this waiver can be leveraged if the dollars that were moving through this system happen to hit nonprofits that are working on prevention programs that are working in the community. You not only get the real dollar value of what those are going to the nonprofits, but you also have the ability of the nonprofits to combine that with other funds that are coming from the community, as well as hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of hours of volunteer work for nothing. So the bang for the dollar is pretty good. From a business standpoint, it makes sense. We're sort of validated in this prevention and early intervention work with families with the RAND report. My guess is you all have seen that RAND report. It really validates that the highest return on investment ends up in parent training, and that would be a part of our prevention and early intervention process. A quick idea of what we've done with the Family Resource Center in Bend. It's been going for nonprofit. It's been going for about 9 years now. We've had about, just in the last 2 years, we've had close to 1,000 families go through a parenting program called Love and Logic. In the Safe Passages, which is a discussion series, in the last 3 years, each year we've had something like 1,200, 1,400 families go through that. We have a warm line in which we are getting calls at the rate of 100 to 150 a month. Half of those are parents asking about, well, I have an idea that my kid's getting into drugs, getting into, is this grades going down? Where do I go for help? What do I do? Those are the kind of calls. We have a system that we answer those with. And we have a parent network. We have close to 200 people in the parent network. So allowing counties like ours to use this waiver makes real business sense. It allows the opportunity for our community and for there to be a process of a continuum and a comprehensive overall plan. We have public safety in Deschutes County covered, as you heard, and we hope you consider this and grant this waiver, and thanks for this opportunity. Thank you.
Lauren is also an accomplished photographer, and he sponsors our show each year that raises money for the Family Resource Center. And about how much a year do you raise?
Well, this last year we raised about 37 net for the Family Resource Center.
So it's primarily supported by local funding, and as you can see, it's been highly successful.
Watch fun.
Questions? Yeah, Peter.
I think we had testimony earlier about your new detention facility there, and I thought the give and take of the discussion was it would be available to other counties in Eastern Oregon for detention purposes. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Is that in these amendments?
I don't think so.
Okay. We passed 942, Mr. Chair, and 941, the Ways and Means Committee, from this, from here to Ways and Means, which two programs, one in Deschutes and one in Lane. Do either one of those bills have to do with young people under 18 years of age dealing with mental health issues?
I believe that, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I believe the juveniles are excluded from both of those. They dealt with adults with mental health problems,
not juveniles.
I dealt with jails. And
we did send down, though, a bill for Deschutes County that I think Linda testified about dealing with female offenders. A pod for 12 in the Deschutes County juvenile detention and with foster care for 6. So that is also down in the community.
And that's available to just Deschutes County or to Eastern Oregon?
Eastern Oregon, a concentration on Central Oregon, and the county's willing to put up the space. So the money is for the operation of the program.
So the county pays the jail, but the state will pay the funds to run it.
Right.
Is that going to be, I'm just curious in terms of bed availability, because there's still quite a shortage, I would assume. That doesn't seem like a lot of beds. Am I mistaken or not, Mr. Chair?
Well, there's still beds available in the Deschutes County Juvenile Center. They're filling rapidly, but because many counties, East Mountains, don't have juvenile beds, one of their options is to bring them to Deschutes County, where they are charged a fee for doing that.
So some of the fillings that are going on, it's not just Deschutes County. They're filling rapidly because they're coming in from outside, or they're filling rapidly because of Deschutes County?
I'd say primarily because they're coming from outside.
That's correct.
You, if the judge sentences a juvenile and they're not going to OIA or wants to hold them, for instance, Jefferson County doesn't have a facility, they have to come to Deschutes County, same with Kirk County.
Kirk County as well.
And I don't know about John Day and those, but I don't imagine they have whole facilities either.
That's true. Chair Brown.
Lenny, you talked about, in terms of the waiver that you feel like you've taken on as a county, your financial needs in terms of the juvenile piece. And I guess, do you have a sense that, can you tell me what portion of that dollars is actually spent on prevention for the older kids, the 12 to 18-year-olds, and what portion is spent on deterrence, punishment, rehabilitation, however you want to describe it?
Well, Senator Brown, I'd have to actually ask Dennis Maloney to give you the exact figures on that. But we certainly believe that over the years we've made a commitment to providing space for juveniles. We've went to the voters. We've asked for money. They've given us the money. We've increased our budget, like I mentioned earlier, 108%. We're counting on increasing it again by close to another 40%. But even with that, there's still a need for early intervention opportunities. And I guess, Denny, maybe you could come up here and address the Senator's question as to what percentage actually is set aside for prevention and early intervention right now.
Senator Bryant, Chair, Senator Brown, for the record, my name is Dennis Maloney. I'm the Director of the Department of Community Justice. And if I get to answer your question, with all the emphasis that the county has had to put on more serious cases, have we still been able to do some primary prevention things with that age group? And I think, I'll give you one example. I believe we're the only county in the state that every municipality in the county has police diversion services funded by local law enforcement to do things immediately at the school level. School resource officers, there's actually, even the community of Sisters now has police diversion services, Redmond, Lapine, Bend, all of those have those type of services. And I think that the point that the Chair Swearingen makes is that we like to think that we have responded to the citizens' concern about serious crime, but what we find is if you don't do something up front of that, you really have to wait till kids get into enough trouble to do something about them that would involve the use of a cell or some type of a facility. I think this waiver would allow the county to move upstream a little bit for kids that are not yet violent or serious enough to be incarcerated, but they're waiting in line, if you would, to get into the system.
Thanks.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Senator.
I just need to respond, I guess, to Mr. Carter, Senator Courtney's observation is that when you talk about Eastern Oregon, you have to remember that it's actually closer from where I live in Pendleton to drive to Portland than it is to drive to Bend.
Mm-hmm.
So when you're talking about Eastern Oregon, there's a huge distance difference there. The second comment I think I'd like to make about the flexibility issue, what I'm hearing from my counties and the people out there is that they have their plans in place. I don't know how this fits into the conversation, but they want the flexibility because they feel that in some areas maybe they need money at the younger ages. But in most cases, they actually need the money at the higher ages. Is that what this waiver is? Is that what we're talking about?
Right. And what happened was the county submitted plans of how to spend a certain amount of money according to the governor's executive order, and those plans were approved. Some counties asked for waivers because they'd already done the high-end at-risk. But most decided to spend the money more in the high-risk area on what they call basic services.
Okay. Right. So I guess that's the higher-end kids, basically.
Okay.
So which of these amendments, then, are we talking about those things yet?
No. The Dash 10 in Section 34 just allow the flexibility of a waiver. So if your county has taken care of or is in the process of taking care of this high-end situation, then you have the flexibility to say, I'd like to spend the money on early intervention.
Okay. Thank you. Yes.
Senator Nelson, I hope you understand the context of my remarks. I'm just trying to make sure the needs of Eastern Oregon are taken care of and that they're better solved as Portland versus. But that's fine. I was just, that's all I'm trying to do. I'm not trying to make you drive anywhere because I don't try to deal.
You don't try to drive
or Eastern Oregonian to do anything. So I'm not trying to go anywhere you don't want to go. You understand, Senator?
Oh, I appreciate that.
Thank you. Well, thank you for coming over today and for your testimony. That will close the work session on Senate Bill 555, maybe even bring it back as early as Wednesday. We shall see. Mr. Taylor, as I look at my teach sheet, will do a work session on House Bill 2305. We have some dashboard amendments.
Sure, members of the committee, you're going to have to give me a chance to at least catch up on my cheat sheet here. Yes, we have the dash one amendments, Mr. Chairman of the committee. We heard this bill, I think back in March. It stands the ground upon which the state may apply appeal circuit court rulings in criminal action to include the following order made after guilty finding either by the court or the jury setting aside or dismissing the charging instrument, an order granting a new trial, and an order dismissing the charging instrument with prejudice. We have the dash one amendments. And we last heard this bill back on the 8th of March, and there is a court case, State versus XL, Schrunk versus Keys, 97 or at 65, where the Court of Appeals did not allow a writ of mandamus, and that was a question that was raised at the last time. The amendments simply add the word modified, so it would allow an appeal if the judge were to modify the order. I know Mr. Penn is here, and I think he testified the last time on behalf of the bill, and I believe Ingrid Swenson, on behalf of the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers, testified also. I think they took different positions.
That's what I recall. But the dash one amendment, simply after the word dismissing is first the word modifying.
Right, is that correct?
Correct, Mr. Chairman. All
right.
What bill is
this? 2305. House Bill 2305. Mr. Penn, do you want to just comment on the significance of adding the word modifying?
Mr. Chair, Dale Penn, Marion County District Attorney. Just remind the committee, this is a very narrow bill. However, there are times when it would be important for the state to appeal. This just authorizes us to do so. The fiscal impact talks about maybe 10 to 15 cases a year, although they can be very significant cases. The term modify is just a little bit broader than the term that was there, dismissal. And there would be times where it would be not a total dismissal, but a modification or a change, and this would just authorize the ability to ask the Department of Justice to file an appeal. It doesn't mandate appeal and certainly doesn't require a court of appeals to hear it.
And so as I see it, in addition to allow the appeal for a dismissal or setting aside, it also allows appeal for a modification of an order.
That's correct, Mr. Penn.
Thank you. Questions, Mr. Penn? Would someone like to move the dash one? Thank you, Sir Carter. Move the dash one amendment to House Bill 2305. Discussion? Objections? Senator Tarnow moves House Bill 2305 to the floor, due pass as amended. Discussion?
I'm a no, Mr. Chair.
We have two no's.
Right and left come together. Yes.
Please note for the record we have two no's.
Yeah.
Yeah. Now, Dave, don't file a more nervous report. Senator Tarnow, would you carry?
I will.
Thank you.
I'll be quiet.
We'll now open a work session on House Bill 2216, and we have dash one amendment.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, you may remember this bill. This was also heard back in March 29th, and you may remember the mayor of Salem testifying in this bill. It requires an offender on post-prison supervision reside for the first 6 months in the county where the offender resided at the time the offense was committed. We had the dash one amendment prepared at his suggestion, and that would basically say that offenses that take place within the institution don't count for those purposes. I did get a note from Virginia Vanderbilt reminding me that this would not apply to parole situations. Parole situations, only post-prison supervision because of the relating clause. But also let you know that we have a bill on for a hearing and potentially a work session later on, 2213, which has similar language. It applies to both post-prison supervision and parole. So if the bill were to be adopted, you would not need the -1 amendment.
And when is that bill?
Within a half hour, maybe.
Within a half hour.
Done today.
Why don't we come back to this and take a look at the other bill then? And if we don't like the other bill, we'll move this.
Sure, we can move this anyway, but it takes care of the situation as it relates to the crime committed in the institution.
All right.
I move the, have you opened the hearing
yet? Yeah.
I move the -1 amendment to House Bill 2216.
Thank you. Senator Courtney moves the -1 amendments to House Bill 2216. Discussion? Objection? So ordered.
Amendment, sir.
On the next one, okay.
They're requiring a no on the -1.
Yeah.
Would you indicate on the -1 amendments and a Q-turn
The reason for that, Mr. Chair, is because you just stated that we have another bill that will address this. And if we don't, if we pass that bill, we don't need the -1 on the next bill. Isn't that what you just said?
I think I just said
it. I'm going to wait until we have another bill that addresses this.
I thought, Mr. Chairman of the committee, if you have before, so you may want to look at your files. We have 2213, and specifies that offense committed while inmate is incarcerated may not be considered in determining county of residence condition of parole.
Everybody understand the history of this bill. If you want to know it, I'll give it to you.
Hey, Courtney, why don't you give us the history of
it? Well, everybody says they do, while their head shakes, at least on this side, so I won't bore them.
No, I don't know the history.
This bill came out of the 1989 session called the Ship 'em Back Bill. It was introduced by Representative Kevin Maddox and Peter Courtney because at least 60% of the people that were coming out of the then prisons in Salem, at that time that's where most of the prisons were, stayed in Salem. And it had a dramatic impact on a lot of things in Salem. So we created a situation that at least for the first 6 months, they had to return to the county of their residence or where they committed a crime, etc. Now, we did provide for exceptions in there. For example, if they married a person here and things like that. It's called the Ship 'em Back Bill, and it passed. I guess what's happening here is we need further clarification, and this rule, and this amendment would say that if you commit a crime inside the jail, that doesn't all of a sudden change your county residence from Multnomah County, where you should be going back to Salem or Marion or, you know, any other part of the state, if we've now shifted, you're still going to go back to where your original crime was. That's what this is all about. I think I'm being right about it. In fact, I know I'm being right.
H.B. 2213 does address that, I believe, on page 3, lines 12 through 14.
What we'll do with the committee's extent, I'd like to go, I'm going to close the public hearing on this for a moment.
Okay.
And we'll go into public hearing on House Bill 2213, invite Dave Cook to come forward.
Okay.
And with this discussion, then we'll be able to not duplicate ourselves.
Chair Bryant, members of the committee, I'm Dave Cook, Director of the Department of Corrections, here to testify on House Bill 2213. 2213 started out as a bill to remove the age limitation for those inmates scheduled to perform boot camp. What's been added to 2213 in the A and Gross version out of the House is, as Senator Cusub mentioned just moments ago, if you'll turn to page 3, lines 12 through 14, I think Senator Courtney and others, it adequately addresses the entire issue of inmates who are convicted. In this case, Senator, speaking specifically of inmates who are convicted of crimes while they're incarcerated in any DOC institution, going to your bill of 1989, essentially clarifying that any crime, whether it occurred prior to their incarceration or during the time of their incarceration, is subject to the provisions of the 1989 bill.
Questions? Mr. Cook?
Can we move that on the
floor? Yeah. Then we'll call. public hearing. Open the work session on House Bill 2213.
I move House Bill 2213A and goes to the floor of the due pass recommendation.
Thank you. The motion is to move House Bill 2213 as engrossed to the floor. Due pass discussion. Objection served. Senator Courtney will carry. We'll now go back to work session on House Bill 2216, and I believe we no longer need the Daffodil Amendments. Is that correct?
Correct. Mr. Chair,
I move 2216. Senator Kutub then moves House Bill 2216 to the floor due pass recommendation. Discussion? Objection? So ordered. Motion carries.
Yeah. Who would like to carry that?
Okay.
All right, thank you, Senator. Pretty sharp, Eileen, for 4 o'clock in the afternoon on Monday. All right.
Now, point 304, you have two sets of amendments, Mr. Chair, and it probably warrants discussion.
Five, seven, these amendments to.
You mean seven?
No, 7-5.
Okay,
I'll have to do that. Say that for you. We'll now open the work session on Senate Bill 775. We have amendments, and it's my understanding there are going to be some additional amendments.
Chair, that's correct, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. This bill comes to us from Senator Kutub at the request of Ed Allen, and the original bill would have transferred the responsibility for CASA court-appointed special advocate program from the State Commission on Children and Families to the Judicial Department. The amendment, which comes from Senator Kutub from the proponents of the bill, would create an interim task force to study the issue. And I also believe that there's an amendment that needs to be made that would clarify some funding for the program for the upcoming biennium. I believe Nancy Miller is here with others to explain the amendment and the amendment to the amendment and the amendment.
Okay. And can I just say, have you seen the letter from Virginia Vanderbilt from Legislative Council on her amendment and why she did what she did? Basically, what Legislative Council is telling us in Section 2 about the blank and the money and the funding issue is that it makes an appropriation bill, which I don't think we can do those over here. And that's why she changed the wording to limit it to Section 1, which is making up this commission of people to making up this group of people to study this. That is why she did what she did. So amending this to put in what I think Ms. Miller is going to come up here and bring forward would probably not work.
Okay. Nancy, if you come forward with who else you were going to be joined by.
And maybe there are two subcommittees and maybe the folks coming up. As I read this amendment, the focus of the study is to be on statewide guidelines and funding procedures as opposed to whether or not the CASA program is effective.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Nancy Miller for the State Court Administrator's Office. We've been working with the Commission for Children and Families and the CASA program on this. We had some wording changes after things went to Legislative Council and when they went back. What our intention was, and Becky Smith from the CASA program or Donald Middleton from the State Commission can clarify this too, I think what our intention was is to take a look at, with this study, the best way to support the CASA program statewide. Where should it be housed? How should it be funded? I know that Ed Allen, the CASA who's been working with Senator Kutub's interest, was really around how can this great volunteer program best be supported. So we may need to work on some of the language, and we'll have to work with Senator Kutub on the other issue, because I certainly understand what you're saying, and Ed will be heartbroken.
From what Virginia said is, even if we just leave a blank, that is probably inappropriate.
Well, I don't think that she indicated that there should be a blank, but whatever we put in there
actually needs to be just what funds this group to do the study.
Okay. And nothing,
not
beyond that. I understand that.
So, Mr. Chair and Senator Kitab, if there happened to be some other amendments that went into this bill that spoke to the actual CASA program and its operations, then perhaps it could change. She said reaching.
I think it's the origination of an appropriation bill in this chamber that can't go forward.
What's happened in the past is I've included that blank for an appropriation, and then it goes down to Ways and Means, and they strip it out because the Secretary's just right. The appropriation bill can't come from the Substitute Committee down. But it does have the effect of getting it down to Ways and Means, even though technically it's probably in error to do.
I'm glad that the study is taking this approach as opposed to whether or not the CASA program is effective. I mean, it's just like some sort of a duh in my book. So it's extremely effective in my experience. I've been extremely grateful for the CASAs and the cases that I've looked on.
And the whole idea behind it, Senator Brown, is actually to bolster it. Get all of those people who want to volunteer and be a part of it to actually get trained and.
Yeah, I just wondered, because I'm a real supporter of the CASA program too, and I was just wondering what the problem was that was being addressed here, that there was, why this came about.
Actually, there are some folks that believe that if the CASA program was housed in the Judicial Department, it might get more attention and appreciation, not that the Commission on Children and Families doesn't appreciate it, but there was some discussion about that. That's what the original bill did. It moved the CASA program from the Commission on Children and Families to the Judicial Department. And there were discussions after the bill came up. It created some discussions, which really was part of the purpose of it. And this, they came to consensus, actually, on this idea. First it was dead, and then it was resurrected in this way by saying, let's look at where it should be housed, how it can best be, guidelines. I'm not going to, if you read section one, it says what they're trying to find out. But actually, what we want to do is create a more effective, perhaps even expanded program.
Do we have an estimate? I know we're leaving it blank, but do we have an estimate for how much this will cost?
For the study?
Mm-hmm.
Nancy, any idea?
Mr. Chair, Senator Burdick, in our conversations, and Donna Middleton is here to speak for the Commission, we've agreed that the State Court Administrator's Office and the State Commission would staff the interim group with current staff, and that the Commission would pay other administrative costs. So that's why we didn't actually have an appropriation for the study itself to start with. We were all very committed to this, and we said we would do it. Our never-ending, overriding concern, not to beat a dead horse, is that CASA is woefully underfunded. We cannot get enough volunteers to be able to advocate for these kids. Folks often have the mistaken belief that volunteers are free. I run a volunteer program in the judicial branch. I can tell you volunteers are not free. They have to be staff-supported. With the woeful underfunding that CASA has, there's not enough money to get the staff to support the volunteers and to train them. It's highly technical work. So we were hoping to do two things with this bill, to address that woeful underfunding and to find the best way to support CASA. Thanks.
I don't think it'd be too expensive, because if they staff it, you're just talking about a little mileage, those sorts of things. So it would be fairly inexpensive. I'm clearly less than probably $10,000. Depending on how many.
Then I wonder why it would need to go to Ways and Means, since the threshold is $50,000.
We need a fiscal analysis on it. Maybe, although if there was administrative support, we probably don't. But
with the DAS 1 amendment,
yeah,
and which completely changes what the bill initially was going to do, we probably shouldn't get a legislative fiscal report on it.
Right, or...
It sounds to me like there's almost a willingness to absorb the cost, and I see head shaking.
Yes. And for the record, I'm Donna Middleton.
Thank you.
Director of Commission on Transgender New Families. And yes, we wholeheartedly support the interim study. I think too often we, and I will say up front for the record, and Senator Qutub has heard this, is that the Commission, because there was no administrative dollars that went with the cost of program from the very beginning, the Commission has not supported the cost of program at the level it should be supported. We have been able to write a federal grant, which has offered us some administrative support, and we have Becky Smith now who is supporting the cost of program. But prior to that, unless it came from someplace else, the cost of was not administratively supported by anyone, let alone the State Commission. And so what this gives us an opportunity to do is to look for what is in the best interest of the CASA program and what is in the best interest of the volunteers that work hard every day to make a difference for abused and neglected children, rather than saying, well, it didn't work, and not really looking at the circumstances about why it didn't work and just moving it. This gives us 2 years to really study the opportunities that we have. The Commission is not saying it should go one place or the other, but we're willing to staff support the interim study to make a good recommendation to the legislature about what kind of support CASA needs in the future.
Oh, that makes sense.
Okay, so, Mr. Chair, what I'm thinking is, I am sure if we want to be able to fund CASA at any higher level, there are other vehicles. This does not have to be a vehicle for that. And perhaps we should just eliminate the Section 2 portion of this bill, which even talks about the funding portion of it, because it actually isn't doing what we had hoped it would do. So, and then deal with the funding in a different vehicle, which would be in the House or a budget or whatever, an ad back or something.
I think that's a good idea. And I think this committee is trying to use our sway and ways and means to find some additional money.
And Mr. Chair, Senator Qutub, Nancy Miller again. I think we're also going to need some very simple amendments on the first page, and that changed a little bit from what we had sent down. If you look on line 7, it says procedures for a court-appointed special advocate volunteer program, and we wanted to make very clear that it is for the court-appointed special advocate program established pursuant to RS 419A-170, the entire statewide program. And I don't know if that makes a big difference, but that was the language that we sent. And the other thing is there are some folks from CASA programs who have traveled really far to be here today, and I don't know if the committee has any time to give them a couple of minutes.
We'll give them a couple of minutes. Why don't you call them up, please?
Thank you.
Chair, while they're coming up, just make a comment. There's a list out today about how much money the Senate has passed out in terms of tax credits and expenditures, and it's about over $100 million over the Senate President's budget. So as we vote out these tax credits and expenditures, which I agree are necessary, keep in mind that we don't know where the money is coming from. So to comment while we're looking at funding very important critical services.
Thank you. My conscience. Nancy, would you like to introduce these volunteers?
That's what I feel like someday. Really, such a small responsibility.
Why don't you begin, and for the record, if you could give your name, please, and where you're from.
My name is Jennifer Hunking, and I'm the director of the Grant County CASA program. And
Grant.
I'm here in support of CASA in general, and any support that you can give us for the volunteers. As a director of a minimum Grant County, we get $1,500 a year on which to run our program. And I'd like to be able to tell you that you can't run a program on $1,500 a year, but we've proven in Grant County that you can. So, but I would agree with the statement of being woefully underfunded. underfunded and undersupported. And as a program director, I feel like I'm not able to support my volunteers. So I'm here to gain support for the volunteers.
Well, thank you for doing that in Grant County. And your name is?
I'm Helen Moore, and I am the executive director of the CASA program in Linn County. And I have been with CASA for 10 years. And the unfortunate thing is our picture has not changed. We are a 501c nonprofit, and our board has to be focused every month on raising money to keep the doors open, to pay the phone bill, to buy stamps, to provide training for our volunteers. And it's very disheartening that we are not making good progress in meeting the needs in our community. We only serve 25% of the children who by law are entitled to an advocate in our county. That's 118 kids that we're serving. That is over 300 kids that we're not. And we don't have the staff time to support very many more volunteers. I have 35 volunteers, and they do take support, training, and direction in order to be effective volunteer advocates.
Chair Bryant, I'm Ida DeZoto. I'm the coordinator for the Polk County CASA program. I have 19 volunteers that serve 103 children. Last year, 134 children came into Polk County's care system, and we were only able to serve one of those children because the CASAs were filled up with the other 103 children. So the need continues. Our program has been in existence almost as long as Helen's, and I was one of the first CASAs in Polk County, and my program was one of the programs that closed down and was shut down for about a year and a half because of lack of funds. And so the support continues and the need grows. Thank you.
Well, thank all of you for your effort.
Yep. I'm just curious from Grant County how many children you're able to serve, either percentage-wise or just roughly?
4 of approximately 30.
Do most of your counties, are the children providing with attorneys as well? I know in some counties, I believe Josephine and Marion, it's the court practice to appoint attorneys for children. I know in Multnomah County that is not the case, and I was just curious in your counties whether that is the case or not.
In Grant County, the children are appointed an attorney, but it's my understanding the attorney only stays with them for a certain period of time, and then they could be assigned 2 or 3 different attorneys during the life of the case, whereas the CASA volunteer is appointed at the beginning and stays with them through the end.
Mr. Chair, it's certainly been my experience in a couple of cases I've been on where I've represented several children and the family. It's been extremely valuable to have a CASA working with the lawyer on the case. It's been very valuable.
We have a new member.
Yes. Thank you, Senator. My name is Mike Elwood. I'm an advocacy coordinator from Multnomah County. I live in Salem. I have about 40 CASAs that I supervise. I spent about 20 years in social services. I used to work for CSD, several years in Lincoln County, so I have quite a broad experience in working with juveniles. I find the CASA program is very valuable as far as early intervention purposes and trying to increase the quality of decision-making for kids who are the most vulnerable in the system. I supervise about 40 volunteers, as I mentioned, and they're very highly motivated, and I think they're giving our program excellent service. We have approximately 600 children that we serve annually in Multnomah County, and we only serve about 13% of the children in that county. We'd like to expand those numbers, and we're asking for your support in doing that.
Other questions? Thank you for your effort.
Thank you.
We'll then close the work session on Senate Bill 775. And Senator Kutub, when the amendments are ready, just let me know and we'll reschedule it.
Mm.
Oh, yes. Sure. We'll reopen the work session on 775, and if you could identify yourself, please.
My name is Larry DeBates, and I live in Yamhill County, and I've been a CASA for the last 3 years in the county, and we've been struggling to keep volunteers going. I'm a volunteer. There's no benefit to me to be involved in the program except the satisfaction to see some of these kids getting a second chance. They're caught up in the system. Now, I had prepared testimony and had handed in to a previous senator, House bill of Representative Mannix's, And I was quite surprised when the funding thing was transferred over here to 555, because I just didn't keep up with the thing. But at any rate, what I'd like to do is, for the record, I'd like to submit my testimony that I previously applied, but I also want to tell you that it's a very important program, and I strongly urge you to increase the funding level of the CASA program, because in Yamhill County, we have been struggling to just keep a very small group of CASA people working. Just because we don't have enough staff to do the training and adequate oversight in facilitating the CASAs. So what happens in many cases, these CASAs come and go quite quickly when they don't get the kind of training and support they need from some minimal staff that this funding would increase. Now, I know also the committee here may be involved at some time at looking at putting a new judge out there. In Yamhill County, we have one of the problems we have in the CASA program is the shortage of judges. And so many times, a CASA and the court schedule a CASA hearing or something to get these children moved through the system, and it's bumped for higher priorities. They're just such a great workflow. And my understanding is there has been a committee put together and has made a recommendation to the legislature, and number one priority for a new judge in the counties up here is Yamhill County. So it doesn't have direct bearing on this, but it fits in with the CASA program. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. Thank you for coming from Yamhill County today. With that, then, we will close the work session on 775, and we'll open a work session on Senate Bill 2304. Invite Dale Penn and Ingrid to come forward. Judy, we heard this bill some time ago, and there were two concerns. This dealt with holding a person, a defendant, in jail for an extended period of time, and the issue was constitutional issue of a speedy trial, and they could extend it, the court, for more than 180 days if there were extraordinary circumstances, but extraordinary circumstances weren't defined. So we have some amendments before us. Ms. Taylor, 2304.
I'm sorry. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Committee, we have the -A3 amendments before you and the -A4 amendments. The A3 addressed the issue that the representative subtly pointed out to the committee and is going to deal with February 9th. And I believe the A4 amendments, they incorporate that and extend it a bit further. And I think they are at the suggestion of Ingrid Swenson in our last meeting on this issue back on March 20th. Am I correct?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Ingrid Swenson, Oregon, Criminal Defenders Association. I certainly talked about the possibility of a sunset provision if the committee decided to go forward with this, because it certainly has been. It is my belief that the measure as drafted amounts to basically a repeal of the 60-day rule, and I think you will find people detained pretrial for a much lengthier period of time if you pass that measure, and it may be appropriate to take another look at it if that's what you're going to do.
You see, the sunset was January 1, 2004. The other reason for the idea of a sunset was maybe Senator Tarnow talking about the cost to jails by the longer incarceration, and he was worried about that particular impact.
So we need both amendments? I can't, or is that right?
Well, right now we're just discussing, okay. And I realize it's been almost right. It's over 2 months since we last looked at this. Senator Cordy.
I'm just getting to know, again, he said, but maybe just so you're aware on these amendments or bill. I mean, I know where you are initially, but where are you on the amendments at all?
Mr. Chair and Senator Courtney, on the -4 amendments, I think those were drafted to do things to address the issues that Mr. Penn raised in his testimony about some minor changes, but also to include a sunset provision, which is one way of addressing. And so I'm in agreement with the sunset if the committee decides to move forward with the rest of the bill, but I certainly testified in opposition to it that it is not needed. The trials go out fairly regularly on schedule, that the state is not prejudiced by that, and that there is no need to repeal the 60-day rule.
So basically, while you support the amendment, even with the amendment, you don't support the bill.
That's correct.
Thank you. I just thank you.
Mr. Pan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dale Pan, Marion County District Attorney. We support the bill, obviously, and we have no problems with the Dash 3 amendments. That is removing the capability for the court to go beyond 180 days. I really don't have a problem with a sunset clause if the committee believed that it was important to review this after 4 years, because I don't believe there'll be any abuse of this at all. There are certain situations that come up all the time in court, and we try to detail those in the list of reasons that a court may decide it's important to retain someone in custody, but the trial cannot proceed within 60 days, and it just gives the court some flexibility. That's all this bill does. It doesn't mandate anything. The only concern I have about the A4 amendments is lines 3 through 5 on the first page of the Dash 4 amendments. And I know this was put in at the chair's request. I wasn't present at the hearing, but there was some concern, and I didn't hear exactly what that concern was, but it details that the reasons under C, D, and E that the court may grant a good cause extension is that the defense attorney cannot reasonably be expected to try the case within 60 days, that the defense attorney has recently been appointed, cannot be ready to try the case, that the defense attorney is unable to try the case because of conflicting schedules. And these are precisely put forward because there are times when a defendant will attempt to fire his lawyer but still refuse to waive the 60-day period. And right now, a judge's hands are tied, and there'll be times where they'll tell the defense lawyer, you go ahead and proceed. You've been appointed. You're going to try this case. And yet a defense lawyer is stuck in a situation saying, I can't be ready. So we build post-conviction issues into the trial. My only concern is the limiting amendment in A4, there on lines 3 through 5, says that this can only be requested by the defendant. And I don't have a problem with the idea that the DA shouldn't request this, but I do think that the court should be allowed on its own basis to say that, listen, all right, defense lawyer, I'm not going to require you to try this case in 60 days because you convinced me you can't be ready. But on the other hand, I'm not going to say that we're going to release the defendant from custody because we can't try the case within 60 days. That's my only concern. Otherwise, I have no problem with the sunset clause and the A4 amendments.
Dale, then, if on line 5, if we added something to the second or the court on its own motion.
Yes, Mr. Chair, that would be perfectly fine with me.
Because I did not intend by doing that to give that technical trap to the defendant. Last time someone was going to check with the sheriff to see what their thoughts on this were. Have you been able to do that?
Mr. Chair, I have talked with Sheriff Robson and with Mr. Spencer, and he was here earlier, but he left. And I believe that they are fine with this bill. I do think they would be much easier if they did have the sunset clause, just in case. I promised Sheriff Robson that if he had a problem, I would be happy to come to his county to help him. But maybe a sunset clause would assist that comfort level.
Mr. Chair, I'm going to make one comment on this, in good person again. The difficulty when you allow someone other than the defendant to waive his speedy trial rights, basically, without his consent, is that you do create a sort of wedge between the defendant and his attorney. It's a difficult position for defense lawyers to have to be ready in a short time frame, and basically they need to protect themselves by not agreeing to be appointed if they don't have time to prepare.
But if they don't do that, you're creating a sort of built-in conflict here where the lawyer says, I can't be ready, and the defendant says, I want to go to trial, and ready or not, I want to proceed. And that doesn't build in post-conviction if the defendant clearly makes that choice on the record of his own free will. And I know some of my members would find it much more convenient if they could convince the court to continue this over the defendant's objection. But that really creates a problem of a conflict between the defendant and his attorney.
From a practical matter, Will, if the defendant demands to go ahead with the trial, even though the court says you shouldn't do this and the defense counsel says you shouldn't do this, what's your experience as far as what the court would do?
The court, in my experience, will often send the case out or can decide that the defendant's release can be safely secured. And all we're talking about here is whether the defendant must remain in custody or not. The trial date can be set over, but if it is set over, he has to be released. So on occasion, an arrangement is made for a defendant to be released. Other times, the case is sent out for trial.
Now, let me just ask this question. I'm looking at the background as set out by Leonard and High Counsel for this committee. Generally, a defendant awaiting trial may not be kept in custody for more than 60 days after an arrest. This rule has several exceptions. It does not apply to a defendant who waives his right to release, so there's that one. They waive it. Keep me in jail. A defendant charged with murder, aggravated murder, or treason. Somebody who's really done it.
Doesn't apply.
What?
Doesn't apply. Correct. Murder, aggravated murder.
Doesn't apply. Right. Okay.
Right.
A defendant already serving a prior sentence. Doesn't apply. And reasonably delay resulting from examination hearing regarding the defendant's mental condition or competency.
Yeah.
You know, I don't know. I'm having trouble there with this one. I really got to tell you. I'm having trouble, first of all, because it sort of gives you the impression that it applies to all defendants, the 60-day rule, when in effect there are some major exceptions to protect society. And you've got a defendant who's got, you know, got some serious problems. They've already demonstrated. If this background statement is correct, then you'd know that better than me. Number two, you go from 60 days to three times increase the period of time. You don't go to 120. You go to 180. You go from 2 months to 6 months. Well, you said it could be up to 180 days, isn't that right?
Yeah.
So you've gone, where am I going wrong here? It's 60 days, it's 2 months. 180 days is how many months?
6 months.
6 months. So we've gone from 2 months to 6 months, as opposed to maybe a 90-day shot.
Yeah.
And I don't know. If we have a system that believes you're innocent until proven guilty, and I understand that, you know, that's the theory. You are incarcerating someone. They're in jail. They have not been convicted of a crime they've been charged with. Now, I realize, I understand that we can't just say, therefore, release everybody, but you and I know why. That basically, we do presume such an egregious confession. But I don't know. I got to tell you, this one, I'm struggling with big, big time.
Can't the court, on the current law, hold someone 180 days? Aren't there two extensions allowed?
Mr. Chair and Senator Courtney, I guess, let me say it this way. Number one, this is not a DA bill. This is a bill to authorize judges to stop game playing that occurs in front of them. You're well acquainted with Judge Greg West. I have heard him many, many times say, why hasn't the legislature given us some authority to show good cause? They have good cause extensions in every other circumstance. Why don't we have it here for 60-day rule? The exceptions that you talked about are very, very narrow. How many people are charged with murder and aggravated murder in the state of Oregon? Not very many. Certainly the 60-day rule does not apply to murder, but that's a very, very small number of people. People who give notice of mental disease or defect offenses for examination, very, very small number of people in the state of Oregon. That's your major exceptions that you just listed.
Well, prior sentence.
Then serving a sentence. Yes, if somebody is serving a sentence and has now been charged with a new crime, they're serving their sentence. So the 60-day rule does not apply to them until they get to the point of completing their sentence. But again, we're talking about small numbers of people. What this really comes down to is if the defendant will not waive, and there are times when a defendant will say, hey, you know, I want you to spend some more time on working on my defense. I'm going to waive the 60-day rule. This is really just a tool that if the judge sees someone coming up and saying on the 58th day, as I have seen happen time and time again, I don't like this lawyer. This lawyer is worthless. They're no good. I want them fired. I can't work with them. And yet they turn right around and tell the judge, but I demand to be tried by 60 days. And the judge says, well, if you don't take this lawyer, how can you expect someone to be able to walk in here and in 2 days or 3 days or 6 days be ready to try your case? It becomes a tool that some defendants use to manipulate the system. All this bill does is say that a judge, when confronted with circumstances, and we detailed some very precise circumstances, they have the ability, if they find on the record, that this is good cause to extend this. The general rule is you must be tried within 60 days. But if the judge says, I believe there's good cause to extend this at 60-day increments, is what the statute says, up to 180 days. So the judge could give a 60-day extension for good cause. But you could have, as you said, two different extensions, but you can't go beyond 180 days. The House bill did allow the court to go beyond that. I have no problem with this committee's amendment to restrict it. It's not going beyond 180 days.
Can I ask another question?
Yes, sure.
I want to come at you for two things. What's good cause? That's a judgment call, isn't it?
Except that, Mr. Chair and Senator Courtney, the original bill did just say good cause, okay? And we gave some a non-exclusive list, this list that's here.
Okay.
The House decided that we should detail this is good cause. This is not a non-exclusive list. This is the listing of good cause. If the court doesn't find one of these circumstances in there, it doesn't go beyond that. So it's a restrictive list of what is good cause. Now, you're correct. In every other circumstances in the law that I know of, never is good cause defined. So this is a narrow bill in defining for the court a narrow exception for these reasons. If the court finds it, the court is authorized to extend the period of time.
Just one last thing, Your Honor.
Yes,
sir. What's magic about 180? Where did that come from? Where was that number arrived at? Where is that? Is that because of the caseloads you people have? Is that the average amount of time it takes you to get all these things to trial? Where is 180 days coming from?
Well, Mr. Chair and Senator Courtney, I don't know that I can answer that totally. Certainly, that's the law now. And that has been as long as I've practiced criminal law. So the last 25 years, this 180-day limit has been there. I will say that speedy trial is a constitutional issue, and I have never seen constitutionally a case where something less than 6 months was considered a constitutional deprivation of someone's right to speedy trial. But this figure has been in there ever since the statute has been in, I expect. And I don't know where it came from, but it started with the 60 days. There are some exceptions, but they are very, very narrow. This simply gives 8 other bases that the court could find good cause for.
Mr. Chair, may I raise a few comments? Thank you. A couple of things. First of all, 180 days may here be indicated to be sort of the outside limit, but I think what you find in these cases is whatever the outside limit is becomes the culture of the criminal court. And if you can get 180 days pretty soon, it's my belief that that will be the standard time in which people will expect to try these cases, not 60 days, which is their current expectation, absent some very specific findings.
In some cases, the 180 days will exceed the amount of time that a defendant can receive in custody as punishment for the crime that he committed. By some, it could exceed it by double. Some of these exceptions simply aren't the sorts of things that warrant this kind of extended period of time in custody. For example, item A, which is in line 5 on page 2 of the bill, talks about the court having failed to comply with 136.145. Well, what that means is that the court is supposed to inquire of the prosecutor when setting a trial date whether the prosecutor has checked with the victim to make sure that the victim can be present. So if the prosecutor has failed to do that, and that's their responsibility, they can then turn around and say, Judge, you know, gee, I didn't do this, so I need some more time. It's putting the onus on the court for having failed to inquire, but indeed it's the prosecutor's duty to find out whether the victim's available before the trial is set. So that does not seem the sort of situation that should warrant. And this is a case where a victim is not a witness, but simply has expressed a desire to be present and has the right to.
Wouldn't the judge have the discretion to say, no, I deny the motion, we're going to go ahead with the trial?
Apparently so, under the language here. That's correct.
And I hope the judge would in that case.
Well, and I suppose I would.
And Mr. Chair, it
serves no purpose whatsoever. Yeah,
I need to put in here, this was discussed on the House side, and the language is very clear. The court failed to comply with the statute, not the district attorney. And certainly, again, this whole bill is discretionary with the court. And there's no mandated language. But a district attorney failing to provide notice, as is required under the statute, that doesn't justify a request for an extension.
Well, Mr. Chair, but 136.145 talks only about one situation, and that is where the judge neglected to ask the prosecutor whose duty it is to have that information and provide it. So it is a prosecutorial failure, and it's just expressed in the courts having failed to make an inquiry. So, and then with respect to the other grounds as well, there just is no justification for that lengthy an extension of time.
Thank you. We'll have to bring the bill back to make that amendment. So,
Chairman,
appreciate it. Yes, Senator Verdeca,
I just had another question. That just the problem, the abuse that you're seeing is people kind of firing their attorney right at the last minute. I'm wondering if maybe it might make more sense to just deal with that situation and maybe have a shorter period or no extension available for some of these other causes. Specifically, the attorney for the defendant, subsection E in line 13, says the attorney for the defendant is unable to try the case within the 60-day period because of conflicting schedules. I don't really know what that means. To me, that seems pretty vague. Why would you appoint an attorney, or why would somebody hire an attorney?
Mr. Chair and Senator Burdick, you'll have a counsel is retained. And they say, my trial schedule goes out for 4 months. I can't try this case in 60 days. What is the judge going to do? I'm going to make you fire your lawyer, and you hire someone else, or you have a lawyer appointed. These are real-life situations that come up all the time. And all we're requesting is the ability of the judge to be able to say, I'm put in a box here, and there is a good cause basis for extension of holding someone in custody. That's all this bill does.
But, Mr. Chairman, in that scenario, if the person wanted that particular lawyer who was unable to try the case within the 60-day period, wouldn't that person be motivated to request the extension which they are able to do?
Mr. Chair and Senator Burdick, that does happen sometimes. However, there are other defendants that will say, I have a right to have this counsel on my case. I've paid for them. And I also have a right under this statute to get out of jail in 60 days because my lawyer is telling you that he cannot try this case in that time. I have heard this stated in court. We wouldn't be asking for this if it wasn't a real life problem. And that's why I believe a sunset clause is fine, because these concerns the defense bar brings forward, they are not practical realities. And I think you'll find after the sunset clause that this is not something that is misused by any court and that it does make the system work better.
Mr. Chair, just one other comment. I think our Multnomah County judges would be happy to do trainings for judges in other counties about how to move these cases along and how they successfully manage all of these issues without releasing people and without forcing people to hire attorneys they don't want.
I don't think you two are going to agree on it. I'm not going to ask him to go
over London's time, buddy. Over London's
time. Follow up on Ingrid's comment. I mean, I haven't sat in that process for a long time, but my recollection is this is not an issue in Multnomah County at all.
Mr. Chair and Senator Brown, it certainly has not been a major one. It's been a long time since I heard any complaints about the 60-day rule in our county.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, I simply say that we have received complaints statewide, and it does come up in Multnomah County, and it is a situation where a judge can say, then I'm going to fire this counsel, except when it's someone who has been retained. And I've seen judges do that, but it is rare when judges want to get that aggressive with a criminal defendant in this kind of situation.
Now
we're going to close the work group on this and come back with the another amendment. Well, now, yes.
Just real quickly before you close that, whose amendments are A3 and whose are A4?
A3 was suggested by Lane Shetterly, and A4 came from this committee last time we heard it.
We'll now go into a public hearing on Senate Bill 226. I'll invite Gary Larson, Kathleen Dotton, and Bob Olson or Carl Myers, whoever is both in here at different times. I don't see him right now.
This is the House Bill 2226.
Okay. And we have some dash 2 amendments here too. We haven't heard this bill. This is a new one. Afternoon.
Afternoon.
Please identify yourself and begin.
Okay. Chair Bryant, members of the committee, my name is Mary Larson, and I'm here today to present testimony in support of House Bill 2226 on behalf of the Child Support Program Director's Office and Department of Justice Support Enforcement Division. You should have before you the ingress version of the bill. In the original form, the bill proposed to include the Support Enforcement Division staff in the definition of public officials required to report child abuse. The bill was amended on the House side to include changes to ORS 419B010 to limit the requirement of public officials to report child abuse to events that are witnessed during the public official's duties. It was also amended to exclude any violation of the reporting requirement from a private right of action or claim for relief. Further, on the Support Enforcement Division issue, all child support program staff are currently included as mandatory reporters of child abuse, and the amendments in the original bill would just serve to add the Support Enforcement Division staff to the definition of public officials. As I mentioned, the amendments to 419B010 would limit the reporting requirement to the events that occur only during the course of the official's duties, and in addition provide that failure to report as required would not give rise to a private right of action or claim for relief. In conclusion, we think the bill would serve to strengthen and clarify the child abuse reporting requirements of public officials, and so we would urge the committee to support House Bill 2226, and I'd be happy to answer any questions that the committee may have in relation to the Support Enforcement Division being included in that definition of public official and would defer to my colleagues that are prepared to testify or answer questions on the amendments.
Why don't we hear from all three witnesses before? So Carl or Bob, who's next?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, Bob Olson, Public Affairs Director, Oregon State Bar. Carl and I are here actually today on behalf of the Professional Liability Fund of the Bar, which also supports the current version of 2226 in terms of clarifying the law and resolving some open-ended liability questions which now exist, and to try to make it a fair kind of treatment of all reporters. So Mr. Hall is out of town. He could not be here, but certainly if there are any continued discussions, he would be glad to participate in those. Carl, do you have any additional comments?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Carl Myers. I'm probably here more on behalf of the House Judiciary Civil or Criminal Law Committee that passed this bill out. I was brought up as, an expert on this issue, and answered several questions and raised a couple of concerns that the PLF had that were incorporated in this bill. Just as a bit of background, Representative Mannix had a bill in the House that required all adults to be mandated reporters essentially 24 hours a day. That met with great concern by the members of that committee. During the discussion, they asked some questions about how it was managed now, and who were mandated reporters and what the bar thought of this, et cetera, et cetera. I gave the two concerns that Kirk Hall mentioned in his letters, and those were adopted into this bill, and the Kevin Mannix bill was dropped, and this became the vehicle. I agreed with support enforcement that I would help pass 2226 because essentially the PLF's concerns were added onto their bill, and that's why I'm here. And I'd be happy to answer any questions that the committee may have about this bill or the process by which we get this bill or the concerns of the PLF.
So under current law, the Department of Human Resources, State Commission, Children, Families, and others already have this protection. And what this adds is the Support Enforcement Division. Is that correct?
That's correct, Chairman.
And then the other change, substantive changes, to eliminate the private right of action, the claim of relief, if the one section is violated. You can still be fined and
correct,
and held responsible.
Correct.
You don't create a private cause of action.
Mr. Chair, I might just add that section creates a statutory duty. With the statutory duty comes a potential civil liability issue. For most professionals, that violation of that is not covered by their malpractice insurance. The PLF is not here because it is a potential claim on cases where that has been raised. They have denied liability. I think their concern, however, is in educating lawyers and making sure we avoid any kinds of liability. And so the clarification of the civil liability is requested.
Questions for the panel?
Mr. Chair, I'm sorry, Carl, and Bob, I missed most of your testimony here, but just a couple of questions. And I guess my concern is, does the bar do any, is there any mandatory training in terms of child abuse reporting? And secondly, if you're talking about the course of the official duties, I assume that means outside the 8-to-5 scope. So what happens if someone referring to here is at the grocery store and sees a child being abused? So they know because it's outside their duties, or what happens, I got a better scenario, what happens if they're shopping for food for the office at the Safeway store, so they're doing it, it's employment-related stuff, but they're doing it outside the 8-to-5. Are they're no longer required to be a reporter? I just am concerned. I'm somewhat concerned about the language. So.
Mr. Chair, Senator Brown, I will not defend the language that the House came up with in addressing it. We were concerned about the grocery store scenario, where a lawyer, doctor, dentist, or any other of the mandated reporters was in a grocery store. There was a spanking going on. what appeared to be a parent disciplining a child. Was that to be reported? Is a mandated reporter to be essentially on duty 24 hours a day, even when they're just a citizen? That was the issue that we raised with the House committee, and they responded with this language.
Okay. And in terms of mandatory training, my recollection is the bar does not require training in the arena of child abuse reporting for anyone. That's part of some of the CLE training that's out there, but no one's required to do it.
Mr. Chair, Senator Brown, I believe that's correct. Family law section offers training on that on a regular basis, but I couldn't tell you, not being a member of the section, how often that is raised. We have followed the curriculum established by CSD, it is not required for the continuation of your license.
Other questions? Thanks for testimony. We have one other witness. And that would be Diane Lancaster.
Good afternoon, Chair Bryant, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Diane Lancaster, Assistant Administrator for Programs at SCS. We are handing out some testimony at this time and a booklet that our office puts out on child abuse and neglect, which is an explanation of Oregon's mandatory reporting law, for your information and possible further reference. We are very supportive of the desire of the Court Enforcement Division of the Department of Justice to join the list of mandatory reporters. We believe this is very appropriate in their work. FEB employees may often obtain information that could indicate that a child is abused, and it makes sense for them to be included in the specified list of mandatory reporting. Reporting, of course, is simply a request for a further assessment of a suspected incident. The reporter does not themselves make that judgment call, but reports it to the nearest office of SCF or another appropriate authority. It seems that over one-third of our reports come in from all concerned citizens and not just mandatory reporters. So we get a number of reports as well from the general public. But over two-thirds of the reports do come from mandatory reporters, and primarily those are physicians, nurses, teachers, and police officers. The current language in the engrossed version of 226A does give us some concern as it amends lines, on lines 41 and 43 in section 2 on page 2 of the engrossed bill, limiting the reporting requirement of the official to in the course of the official's duties. And as our testimony comments, when the current statutory language was adopted in 1995, testimony then described a case of a school staffer who did not report a serious case of sexual abuse and then argued successfully later that the girl who told him about the abuse during non-school hours, and therefore he was not required to report. And in that case, the abuse continued for some time later. So we have concerns. We rely upon teachers and off-duty police officers and others who are skilled in seeing and recognizing what child abuse may look like. And we have found that this has been most helpful. So we would like to have a serious consideration of the change in that particular part of the bill. Any questions? I'd be happy to answer.
Do you have an objection to the amendment that includes dental hygienists?
Chair Bryant, no, we do not.
Other questions?
Senator. Taylor. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. When you talk about abuse, the statute says any assault. Now, that's on page one of the bills. And I can understand what assault is because it refers to 163. And then it says any physical injury. For example, earlier we had a discussion about a child in the supermarket. Mm-hmm. Now, assault usually by the courts means more than lacking physical injury. It doesn't mean a slap. What do you interpret as any physical injury to mean?
Physical injury, Chair Bryant, Mr. Taylor, physical injury is generally there will be a physical indicator, bruises, welts, reflecting a hard action against the body, or a shape of an article that was used against the body, burns, rope burns, lacerations, cuts, that sort of thing.
Chairman, if I could go just a step further. So we're now in the supermarket, and a person, a public or private official, is in there to buy food, and they see a parent, they seem to be a parent, slap a child. Because for whatever reason, would that be considered any physical injury that would require them to report?
Not necessarily. A slap of a child, if it does not produce some visible injury, would not necessarily constitute physical abuse. Now, it could possibly indicate some mental abuse or some other, some other indicator there. But in terms of physical assault, no, sir.
In your opinion, now assuming that all I did was left a red mark on the child's face, in your opinion, would they be required to report?
Well, we're speculating here, sir. If the person who was seeing the action was around long enough to see that red mark and to see that it was significant, I believe they would have an obligation to report.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
The testimony of Mr. Hall, the written testimony, indicates, child abuse may include things including verbal abuse. How does that fit into this whole scenario if you see somebody hollering at somebody?
Senator Bryant, Senator Nelson, these incidents, of course, are all, they're all individual and case-specific. I think we've all encountered situations like that, and probably many of us have wondered, should we do something, should we intervene? It would obviously depend, I suppose, on the tenor of the conversation that the parent was having with the child, whether the child was visibly terrified or shrinking away from the adult, looking around for help, say. Obviously, a person simply telling their child loudly to sit down in the seat of the grocery cart, for example, I'm sure that happens. Again, it's definitely an individual case by case. Most of our reports do not come from grocery store incidents, however. They come from observations by teachers and others who have occasion to see that lasting mark on the child's body or, something serious in the child's behavior that would indicate serious abuse.
I guess probably verbal would be more of a threat of harm, and it has to be real. But there is some subjectivity involved in this.
Exactly, Senator Bryant. Obviously, if a parent is screaming at the top of their lungs in a public place that they're going to kill their child, I would hope all of us would, take action. Right. Thank you, Senator.
If you are someone licensed in the state of Oregon for your profession and you violate the statute, do you know if you could lose your license?
Senator Bryant, I'm sorry, I don't know that specific question, given the different licensing boards.
Right, probably depend on each licensing board, whether or not that would be considered a violation that is justified. Senator Bryant?
I'm just curious whether you had an opportunity on the House side to express your concerns about the amendment and whether you've talked with other folks about your concerns.
Senator Bryant, Senator Brown, we did not, at the time, I was not present at the House. I understand that this was suggested fairly late in the hearing, and the SCF person did not have an opportunity to get back up to the stand to speak. To be honest with you, we have had some confusion about getting together with some of the other agencies that are here today. And so we have not probably done as well as we might like to in connecting with them. However, I did speak with a couple of the representatives outside the hearing room earlier, and I certainly understand what their position is. I don't know what to suggest as a compromise position at this point.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Other questions?
Just a comment. I mean, even in my practice as a family law lawyer, I don't remember actually seeing children around. So if there's any point in having attorneys be mandatory reporters, it would make sense that it would be outside the scope of their office practice. I mean, my guess is there's probably fairly few attorneys that actually come into contact with children. So if they're going to be, if we're only holding them to this responsibility while they're actually in the scope of their employment, I'm not sure there's any point in having attorneys be mandatory reporters. I'm not sure that's where folks want to go, but that's just a comment.
So what you're suggesting then would on lines 41 and 42 eliminate the bold print and have it mandatory all the time. Discussion, Sarah Tito.
I guess I'm wondering just how often we were given a case here where somebody used that as a defense. They were a school counselor, and because they talked to the girl after hours, they used that as a defense, I guess, because they were not on their official duty. Clearly, I think that person in that case probably should have reported that. But I am wondering how much of a problem this is, that we would require the individuals not, while in the course of their duties, to report this. It seems to me quite broad to require that. And if we don't have incidents of this happening, of course, maybe we don't hope to. I suppose there would have been other cases if it was happening
frequently,
that we.
Well, and you hope that the people duty part of the time would report it all of the time.
And to Senator Brown's issue about the attorney, what I thought of when I saw that was there might be cases where they're dealing with one, well, let's say it's family law attorney, and they're dealing with one spouse with a dissolution. Dissolution of their marriage.
Divorce.
And the one spouse said that there was some child abuse and then brought the child in. Something like that. I could see where it would happen that an attorney might get that information and then it should.
What's the preference of the group? We don't have to decide today. This is a House bill. Senator Brown, if you want to go ahead and have amendments drafted, the rest of the committee can think about that. But that would be the main issue. By adding the non-liability civility, that does seem to have some additional protection. We'll
close the public hearing then on House Bill 2336.
And open the public hearing on House Bill 2365. And Mr. Taylor, unless someone's arrived late, I don't have a witness on this.
Mr. Chairman of the committee, the only one that I could think of that may have an interest would be Ingrid Swenson, but she was here and I didn't sign. I guess, Mr. Chairman of the committee, everyone must feel it's a good bill and it should pass.
We're passing it.
Ingrid, do you want to testify on this? It establishes that a copy of an administrative rule admitted in a proceeding involving driving while under the influence need not be certified in order to be admitted into evidence.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my legislative committee reviewed that bill, and I am not here to testify on that one.
Right. So you want me to move it?
We're going to go then into a work session. Senator Courtney moves House Bill 2365 to the floor. Do pass. Discussion? Objection?
Public hearing. I can't wait to say certain things before.
I know. This is going
to be a bill. We're a on public hearing. We just did it.
We'll open the public hearing now on House Bill 2325 and invite Maureen McKnight and Lane Barlow. I believe this is our last bill for the day.
Good shot. This one.
Maureen, why don't you begin?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Maureen McKnight. I'm a member of the work group convened by the Interim House Judiciary Committee, the work group that developed this bill. On that work group were Representatives Lane Shetterly and Judy Herbelow, U.S. Attorney's Office, several district attorneys, Sheriff Stan Robson, several victim advocates, members of the defense bar, and representatives of the State Court Administrator's Office. Since the bill's been drafted, I've also been working with the state police on elements of the bill that relate to law enforcement data systems. What this bill does is to make Oregon's statutes on enforcing foreign restraining orders consistent with the provisions of the Federal Violence Against Women Act. What we have right now in Oregon is a state law passed in 1991 that says a restraining order from another state is good for the first 30 days that the protected person is here in Oregon, and the peace officer would arrest if the officer has probable cause to believe that order has been violated. After 30 days, though, under current law, a protected person has to file a copy of that restraining order with the court. And those provisions of current state law conflict with a federal statute, which sets out terms that states have to abide with to give full faith and credit to provisions, or full faith and credit for foreign protective orders. And those terms are detailed on the bottom of page one of my testimony, which I won't go through. But what the work group essentially did was take into account several things. And the first is that the federal law compels full faith and credit for foreign restraining orders and stalking orders without regard to how long the protected person has been in Oregon. And it also compels recognition of more orders than just the category that our state law protects. Even criminal orders that meet the federal standard, for example, no contact orders in criminal cases will be covered under the federal law. And thirdly, the federal statute didn't require judicial or law enforcement registration of the foreign order, something our state statute did. The work group decided not to require registration to get that interstate recognition, but to allow the protected person to choose to file it with the court or to choose to file it with law enforcement. And we think that choice would be one encouraged for persons protected by the restraining order, but we wanted to leave that an option given the fact that there are safety implications to registering an order. It can let the respondent know where you are. Just a very short overview of the bill. Section 1 provides definitions for protective order. We've essentially listed the federal statutory definitions. Section 1 also provides that an order is enforceable here in Oregon as an Oregon order immediately upon the protected person's arrival in the state. So it's clear that Oregon would be using its enforcement remedies to enforce a California order, for example. Section 1 also sets out exceptions to enforceability. It authorizes the state police to specify the data that's needed to enter the order into LEDS and into the national registry, and it allows but doesn't require LEDS and judicial registration. The other sections of the bill conform mandatory arrest provisions, immunity for law enforcement, and remedies against a protected person who misrepresents the status of a foreign order, all of those amendments making it consistent with Section 1. Section 5 repeals the current statute. What this bill essentially does is cure the preemption problems that exist right now between state and federal law, and does so in a way that the work group felt was sensitive to the safety concerns of domestic violence victims. Thank you.
If you don't comply with federal law in making it consistent, are there penalties that can be imposed on the state?
Senator Bryant, not that I'm aware of. It's simply a function of inconsistency of statute and confusion toward law for law enforcement and courts.
Frequently when we get a mandate from the federal government, if you don't comply, there's a financial penalty in some way, and that's the reason I ask.
There's none in this bill.
Yes. Ms. McKnight, isn't it true that even if we don't comply, if we don't pass this law, we still have to recognize those out-of-state orders?
Chair Bryant, Counsel Taylor, that's correct. As a matter of federal law, because of preemption issues, we would still have to recognize and obey the federal law, despite the fact our state law right now on the books is inconsistent.
And that has caused you confusion in the past with law enforcement officials?
It's caused a great deal of confusion, Mr. Taylor, for both courts and law enforcement, who routinely tell individuals to just go down and get a new Oregon order, for example, and don't understand the interstate implications of enforcing that an out-of-state one is enforceable here in Oregon because of federal law.
That's constitutional, is it not?
It is. It is.
statutory, federal statutory law, the full faith and credit provision of VAWA, but the Congress's power to legislate is constitutional from the full faith and credit clause.
Okay.
Okay.
Mr. Barlow.
For the record, Lane Barlow, Oregon Men's Association, how technical do you want me to get? First of all, the violence against Federal Violence Against Women Act has problems. It's a significant operative portion of it has been declared unconstitutional by the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals. Our research shows that the Ninth Circuit has yet to address the Violence Against Women Act in any way. We're at a place right now where we've been before here before this committee. If federal law is supreme, why does the state have to pass it into law? Why isn't this a matter for the federal courts and the federal police rather than the state police? Well, the question is in this. Congress is without power to regulate purely private conduct. That is within the realm of the state to deal with. I realize, if you had a chance to study Burgon-Cola versus VPI State University, that you'll find that that is an intrastate case, an in-state case rather than interstate case, whereas the parts of the Violence Against Women Act we're talking about, we're talking about an interstate restraining order, of course. But again, we're running into some constitutional problems of Congress coming to Oregon and telling you guys what to do to pass into state law. Again, we get into the same situation where we had previously with Prince versus United States. You'll find in my attachment there that that case by the U.S. Supreme Court is quoted along with United States versus Lopez and several others. It's simply this. The federal program, the feds are actually prohibited by the Constitution from basically commandeering the state's law enforcement agencies to carry out their wishes and their programs. We're running into that program here. The typical situation that is presented by this typical scenario is this. You got a mother who is labeled a victim merely because she has filed a restraining order. There's been no due process. There's been no trial. There's been no adversarial proceeding where she's able to be, where her allegations are able to be challenged. So this mother, often with 40 to 50% of the time as children, with her has now fled another state and fled into Oregon. A father is searching for his missing children, and he's presumably hot on his heels. Well, she pops up in Oregon with a restraining order that she claims to be true, and under the proposed law here, without presenting a court-certified copy from the original issuing court, we give her a free ride for 30 days. Why is the state of Oregon participating in a parental kidnapping, which is what is happening here? The only difference between a person taking off with the kids and kidnapping the children, a parent kidnapping the children, and another parent not kidnapping the children, is because of how Oregon wants to deal with it. This is a matter that's not going to go away this session, next session, or before. We propose some adjustments to the bill along these lines. Number one, how about some authentication? That if a petitioner for a restraining order shows up in Oregon and expects Oregon to honor that bill, yes, there are people who are fleeing other states for into Oregon for legitimate safety reasons. We're not so blind that we don't see that happening. We have daughters, we have girlfriends, we have wives. But the problem we have is that you've got a burden of proof here that's just shifted from the accuser to the accused. Now that raises a significant constitutional problem. You have this court's entire awesome power, through its police powers, making a knee-jerk reaction based on an ex parte, which means an unchallenged, one-sided, three- or four-minute proceeding in another court in another state. It's a problem here, and it's a problem in the other state. We propose you do several things. Number one, forced authentication. If somebody's going to show up with a restraining order from another case, it's got to be certified by the court issuing in the other state, along with the proof of service. Now, those of you that don't work within the judicial system, lawyers every day, you may know this. If there is an order from another state that's got a court certified stamp on it, it's all stapled together with a court certification on it. If that staple is broken, it is no longer court certified. Those are the kind of things that need to be looked at. Along with that needs to be proof of service upon the so-called respondent who's presumably in the state looking for his children. We would have no problem if there was some authentication, and particularly along the lines of court certification, just tweaking on a little bit of language that's in here. Other than that, well, I got a lot of notes. I can get as detailed as you want.
Senator Bryant, if I may?
Yeah.
Just three brief points. First of all, the attacks on the Constitutional Right of Violence Against Women Act are not relevant to this particular bill because this bill was enacted pursuant to the Full Faith and Credit Clause and not the Interstate Commerce Clause, which is the basis for the attack that Mr. Barlow is referencing. But in regards to the other two concerns he mentioned in terms of authentication and true copies, those were concerns addressed by the work group, and we've addressed them, frankly, in Senate Bill 318, which came out of this committee. Section 9 of that bill requires the clerk to provide a petitioner on request two exemplified copies of the order. It was done precisely for the concern that Mr. Barlow mentioned, so that petitioners were given authentic or had certified copies. It is addressing Oregon orders. We did not, as a work group, address the issue of authentication for foreign orders coming in, but were concerned about the ability to, or rather, creating a burden on these petitioners who were subject to whatever the laws were in their state about when certified and authenticated copies were available. We think that the National Protective Order Registry, which requires certification for entry, will go a long way into providing the kind of authentication that Mr. Barlow is referring to.
What was the Senate bill you referred to?
Senate Bill 318, Section 9, Chair Bryant, requires the clerk of the court to provide exemplified copies. And that same bill in Section 1 requires the sheriff here in Oregon to provide a petitioner with a true copy of the proof of service, again to address the issue Mr. Barlow is concerned with, so that a petitioner who is leaving Oregon has both exemplified copies of the petition and a proof of service that she can take with her to the other state. To the extent that Mr. Barlow raises those issues, they were addressed by the work group with this result.
Mr. Sheriff, I may. A reading of Bert von Kolla raises another concern, which is very valid here. One of those is the prohibition, not a full faith and credit notwithstanding, against Congress regulating purely private conduct. A person beating and committing other, of course, committing other criminal acts upon an intimate is not private conduct, it's a crime. A father looking for his missing children is private conduct. He is fully within his rights within both the federal and state constitutions. In fact, the federal constitution creates a zone of privacy, a private realm that no state or federal authority can enter. If a man is legitimately looking, the father is legitimately looking for his kids, get out of his way. And we need to, again, I reiterate, let's not have a knee-jerk reaction. Let's not make Oregon a party to a parental kidnapping just because on the surface it looks like it's legitimate.
And, of course, this could work either way. It could be either the male parent or the female parent. And in Oregon, anyway, if you did this in a way that was a custodial kidnapping, it's a violation.
If I may, Mr. Chair, just one comment. Male, female, it really doesn't matter. As long as it is a legitimate exercise of the state's police power, that it needs to happen. We're just concerned that it be legitimate. Let's have some authentication here. Let's not have somebody just a hostile person saying, yes, this is a legitimate order here to the police officer, where the father is going to be locked up with a $5,000 mandated bail for looking for his own kids. Let's make sure these are court-certified orders presented to the police officer. Let's just have some authentication. That's all.
Yes, Mr. Carroll.
In the House side, what was the gist of the discussion regarding reasonable notice? I'm kind of curious. If a lady took a small child and split into Idaho, or a man, whatever, and she gets into Idaho and she obtains a restraining order against her husband, who she fears may be chasing her into Idaho, how do we show that he was given reasonable notice?
Chair Bryant, Senator Tarnow, on that example in particular, it highlights a problem with the understanding of restraining orders. If you have an Oregon relationship and one party flees to Idaho, Idaho does not have power to issue a restraining order because Idaho does not have the connections with that abusive person in order to tell him to not do or do anything. But that is the problem, that many people believe that that new state could do that, and it can't. But in terms of the reasonable notice question, what this bill does is say that Oregon must honor a restraining order from Idaho or from another state as long as that state, which had the power to enter the order, and it's where the abuse happened or where both the parties were, probably where the abuse happened, as long as that state gives reasonable notice to the respondent. And that notice and that hearing might not have occurred by the time she fled to Oregon. And all Oregon could do at that point is treat it as its own ex parte order that hasn't had a hearing yet, which just says the respondent couldn't be punished in that scenario or arrested for violating it because he doesn't even know that order exists yet if he hasn't been served with it. Oregon would have to treat a foreign order the same way it treats its own orders, even ex parte ones, and that notice and the opportunity to be heard on whether that order should even exist at all would be in the state that issued the order, which would be the state very probably where the abuse occurred, not the state where the person fled to.
Chair?
Yes.
I still don't know what reasonable notice means. Does it mean the proper server serves a writ on the individual who is to be served and who is to be restrained?
Senator Turner, I apologize if my first answer wasn't clear. Reasonable notice under the federal statute basically says, according to how the states define it, as in each statute that each state has a law about getting restraining orders, and each state has a time frame in which a respondent who disagrees with the order can go to court to argue about it. And in Oregon, that happens to be 5 days or 21 days, depending upon what kind of relief you've requested. What the federal government says, as long as that's reasonable under your state law, then that's the kind of order you have to recognize.
Sure.
Yes, that's right.
Phone call, letter, postcard, certified mail. How do you make notification?
Okay. Senator Bryant, Chair Tarnow, that would be a function, again, of the state law. But in order to hold someone in contempt of court to punish them for violating the order, you need to have proof that that order has actually, the person has actual notice of it. And I'm not aware of any states that allow restraint in abusive situations on the basis of a phone call. You're talking about personal service by a sheriff or another entity. I hope that's responsive.
Other questions? Thank you for your testimony.
Thank you.
We will now close the public hearing on House Bill 2325 and also the work session on House Bill 2325.
Chair, I move the bill to the floor. Senator
Brown moves House Bill 2325 to the floor to pass. Discussion?
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I will support the bill to the floor. I may be a no. I'm a little bit close to the Constitution process. But I'll support it.
Charter? Other? All right. the motion carries, but two senators note they may change their vote on the floor.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, I'm happy to carry it.
Thank you, Senator Brown.
Oh, boy, oh, boy, oh, boy. Yeah.
I'll be ready for your question.
Okay, that's fine. I'll bring that to you.
They're always going on the party to catch.
Oh, yeah, and I stuffed them in with other things.
I look at the rest of them. See, I'm not going to.
Okay.
The notice? Oh, sure. They didn't want to go to the back on that.